I'm being told by the committee secretary, by way of feedback, that he informs me that we're supposed to be 11. Now, I wanted to know 11 in terms of what? In terms of the X, I don't think the X is perhaps the number, but it's in terms of the rules. Our rules governing this building committee and whether we actually specify the number 11 or in terms of some resolution. But maybe going forward,
requirement for the court.
assume that quorum would be 7, and therefore, when it comes to decision, leave it upon ourselves to do whatever we can to secure the requisite number to constitute a quorum in order to make decisions. If we fail, obviously, we would unfortunately have to reconvene for the purpose of making the decision. Would that be fair enough for the sake of progress? We do not know the reasons of those that are not here. Those that have tendered apologies, obviously, the secretary will give us a readout on this. But we also accept that people might have emergency situations that we do not know of at this stage until we receive that information.
Mr. Chairman, can we please hear the apologies, what the excuses are, why people can't be here, for those who just take the trouble to put in an apology?
Yeah. That's exactly what I'm dealing with. It looks like you want to take over the chair. I'm sorry, next time when the voting patterns change, maybe you will be in a better position to assume my role, but will not allow me to chair. I happen to be the majority party in the state. Alright. Okay. Can we hear if we have any apologies for the
Mr. Chairperson, we receive only two apologies. One from Professor Davan Dava. It was something other than his constituency, which has been arranged quite some time ago. There's nothing that he could do about that. And also the same with Ms. Yengene. We receive an apology from those two.
We request the secretary to write to the members that have not forwarded apologies to inform them that the committee is not in receipt of their apologies and request that they advise the committee in writing accordingly as to why they were not able to attend. Because one accepts that maybe apologies get lost on the way or something. So you always give people the benefit of the doubt until you have the full facts. All right. On that note, I think we should proceed with business and see how we then, at a later stage, come to decisions by way of approving the respective documents.
Chairperson, thank you very much. I do note that item 2 is the adoption of committee report. We will keep copies of it. The other item, the consideration of consideration of research and analysis of extra budget and strategic plan. Is there a document?
The strategic plan and budget. I requested the committee secretary to circulate a document, a draft report. Obviously, I wasn't here in the last meeting because of the Ministry of Commission, and I was quick to ask the chairmanship of the committee. My understanding is that a draft report had since been circulated to all members. Is that correct? Has anybody, have members received the draft report?
Which one?
Obviously, it would be a draft that needs to be considered by the committee. And we have to decide whether we comfortable with the content thereof for purposes of adopting it today. Mr. Singh,
Chairperson, I've got a report which is titled Report of the Standing Committee on the Auditor General on the Annual Report of the Auditor General for the 2010-11 financial year.
Yeah.
I think that's item 2.
Yeah.
But I don't seem to have anything.
And there's another document. Report of the Standing Committee on the Auditor General on the budget and strategic plan of the Auditor General for 2012-2013. You don't have the draft of that?
Sure.
All right. You do? This one. All right. Look, I accept that this may be short notice, and we have to look through the documents and be happy with the content. Look, I will suggest that we actually further MCC 10, I would have preferred to give the officials the first opportunity, but because I want to be able to, for us to be able to take decisions whilst we still have a quorum, I'll prioritize matters that need decision. Except, to what extent does this briefing affect our decision on the last item? The briefing is on the audit directives and audit targets. Are they part of the strat plan? Are they necessarily a component of the strat plan? So I would assume that for us to adopt the strat plan, we do need that. Am I correct? All right. So we probably will need to take that briefing as well. How long have you prepared for your presentation?
Good morning. About 15 minutes.
About 15. Should we take the briefing first? And then deal with our decision making process. And then we can release the official. Would everybody be comfortable with that? I think procedurally it would be a proper way of otherwise how we deal with the strat plan, aspects of which have not yet been presented. Yes, Mr.
Chairperson, included in the draft stress plan. Very sorry about that. It's from Parliament. Included in the draft stress plan document is page 5 where they talk to recommended audit tariffs and audit directives. Where they say here that in terms of audit directives, section 13(1) of the PAA requires that the AG, after consulting the oversight mechanism, must determine the standards and the nature and scope of audits, etc. So that's the audit directive. So it's after consultation. So I will take it that this is a consultation. It's not in consultation. They can do what they like at the end of the day, but they just tell us what they're doing. That's what after consultation is. That's on the audit directive. And on the audit tariff, section 23(1) requires the AG to determine the basis for the calculation of the audit fee to be recovered from auditee after having consulted the oversight mechanism and the national grid. So I think that this is the consultation. So consulting that. So let us know what this is.
Shouldn't we nevertheless give them the first opportunity of consulting and then we can deal with that after? All right, on that note, then, I will allow team from the Auditor General to proceed and introduce the team and go ahead and present as they wish. Thank you.
Honorable Chairman, good morning, honorable members and distinguished officials. Thank you very much for your warm welcome this morning, and it's a pleasure to see so many familiar faces again after your visit to our offices in Victoria a few months ago and our offices here only a few weeks ago. Let me also thank you for making time to attend to these important matters, very important matters in the life of the Office of the Auditor General. We really do appreciate the effort distinguished members of the committee are making. Let me also, on behalf of the Auditor General, Mr. Chairman, tender his apologies. The Auditor General has, since the 1st of November, been undertaking his roadshows on PFMA audit outcomes. It involves daily visits to the different legislatures around the country and daily visits to the premiers and the executives in each province. He was in the Western Cape yesterday and met with the provincial legislature and the team here as well as our staff. And today his visit takes him to the Limpopo province. You can appreciate that this has been set a while in advance and there are many other parties involved. So he sends his apologies. The DAG is indeed away out of the country. He's been away, will be another weekend to send his apologies also. The committee has been very busy, your committee has been very busy with Auditor General matters for a few months now. And over this period, Mr. Chairman, you have met different people from our office. We started with meeting the strategists. You also met finance people as they discussed the budget and annual report. And today we get the opportunity to present our audit technician to the committee as the emphasis is moved to the question of the audit directive. So as a team, the officials are from our office that you're already very, very familiar with, Mr. Sianda Santis from our parliamentary office in Cape Town, and Mr. Sianda from the Deputy Auditor General's office in Pretoria. And the two lovely ladies with me, Chairman, on my right, the leader of our audit research unit, Linda LaRue, and with her, Charmeline Petzer, a senior manager in our research unit. My name is Imran Venka. I'm the corporate executive responsible for audit support. The audit support in our office includes all of the technical matters, as well as the office of the CFO, as well as the quality control unit, all those components in my portfolio, and our international audit work. With that lengthy introduction, let me now get into the matters here. Chair, the committee has already been through the annual report of the Auditor General, this document here, and you have your committee report which you're going to deliberate on later, and I'm just offering this as a snapshot of how we got into today. You've also, at a previous meeting, considered our blue book. The committee has also considered our blue book, which the committee is in the process draft plan. Process of considering. And during the last presentation by the Deputy Auditor General, he introduced the topic of the budget, he introduced the topic of the audit tariff, and he introduced the topic of the audit directive. What was left was to discuss the matter of the audit directive a little bit more detail, and so that's the purpose of our visit here today. The process of consultation, as the senior members have already identified in the Public Audit Act, has been one that started a few months ago. The process we have followed is that we recognize that the audit directive is not a new document. It's a document that has been in existence now for 6 or 7 years. There have been 4 or 5 revisions to it. Has provided important input in the consultation process in the past. So we're starting with a well-known document. What we were able to do for purposes of the draft we bring to you today is our experts have updated it based on the direction and inputs of the Auditor General and our executive leadership as to what is new that we would like to be doing. We have consulted with a statutory committee in our office called the Technical Committee, made up of representatives of the technical representatives of various structures in our office. And Mr. Chairman, the committee will be very pleased to hear that for the very first time we undertook a formal consultation process with the organized auditing profession in South Africa. So the directive was tabled at what is known as the Public Sector Committee of the Independent Regulatory Board of Auditors, IRBA. The committee had an opportunity to provide its input and we incorporated its comments into this, and it was very warmly received by the profession. And in that committee, we have representatives of those private firms, of academic institutions, of the regulatory body itself, and of government. And they were big players in, for instance, the regulation of the audits of state-owned entities, and we were able to provide inputs during that phase. So it's fair to say that we have undertaken a number of steps in the process of consultation leading up to this important visit with the committee today.
I thought there's only one public sector auditor, which is the Auditor General. Would the other auditors include the internal audit committee or whatever? Just elaborate on who constitutes the public sector audit.
Mr. Chairman, thank you for the opportunity to clarify that. As members of the committee will know well, approximately one quarter of the work of the audit Auditor General in South Africa is done by private firms on our behalf. And so we have the regular big names, medium-sized firms, and small firms in South Africa doing some hundreds of millions rand of work on our behalf in a practice that goes back several decades and one that is closely linked to our strategy. And so they are registered auditors, and they register with a regulatory body known as the Independent Regulatory Board of Auditors. Chairman, so on the document we have with you today, we've only prepared three slides. It's really not something that has a great deal of change. I mean, provide some in the first slide describing what the purpose of any directive is. In this case, the AG audit directive. In the second slide, I will talk to what the key features of the 2012 directive are. And finally, for benefit of members of the committee, we summarize in just one page what the key changes are from the 2011 directive to the 2012 directive. So hopefully you will be able to digest the changes. Let me say as a broad outline that this document is only really 9 pages long, the Auditor General Directive. It has 11 pages of examples and annexures. And decision trees to assist the auditors in public practice to apply what the 9 pages of directive instructions say. This year, Mr. Chairman, we have made a concerted effort to tame language the directive in the consistent with our first goal around simple and clear messages. So even someone like me now understands it. There's the addition of the flowchart, which I think is very useful to the private firm. We know well that Parliament has a keen interest in the work that private firms do in auditing those institutions that we don't audit. And this directive plays a very important role in defining and describing the work they do and how they should go about doing it. So at its highest level, the directive covers what is a public sector audit as distinct to a private sector audit where there's only an opinion on the financial statements. And here we introduce the concept of a compliance element, which is very important in our land. There is a service delivery perspective, which is very important in our life, in addition to the financial statement opinion. We also, as recommend members of the committee, describe what are the standards that regulate the work in the public sector. Now, the Auditor General has for over a decade drawn his complete audit inspiration from the international standards of auditing, which happens to be the common standard that the private firms use in South Africa. However, we have added to that the elements of the International Supreme Audit Institution standards, the INTOSAI standards. So we built that into our manual, and we wish to make the members of the other auditors aware that this is what inspires our work. And those are the two key elements. However, we also do a number of unique arrangements in South Africa, performance audits, special investigations, service delivery, reporting, all matters prescribed by law, and we provide in this directive a little owner's manual for the auditors out there to know what it is that entails the public sector audit and which standards they should be following. And finally, the third element of this directive deals with some of the logistical matters around you need to appoint your auditor by this day, you have so many days in which to do it, the report must be tabled here, remember to send it to Parliament, remember to send it to the AG, those sort of things that someone who is not on our side of the table may not necessarily know, and the directive helps to cement those arrangements. Particularly and very importantly, the question of how you appoint your auditor. So if you're a large parastatal, how do you consult and advise the AG? What process should you follow? And that's those sort of arrangements. Mr. Chairman, the key features of this year's directive are that
please let a quantum of your briefing just on the introductory aspect you just covered. I took interest in the deliberations in Queen myself in Pretoria as a magistrate commission. And I observed that there were questions raised relating to whether the parastatals, which are not audited by yourself but by private firms, of course, with your supervision, are applying exactly the same level of rigor in their auditing processes. And if not, could that explain why they audit higher than government departments in terms of the percentage of positive audits compared to what the government departments tend to get? That was the one issue out there, and I thought that is an issue which becomes relevant for us as the body that is supposed to approve your audit directive. And now in your presentation, now you also allude to the fact that whereas they would apply the general standards, you also in addition would impose upon yourself the intersite standards, which sounds like it's an additional level of rigor. And couldn't that also be explained? The differentiation there between the standards that you follow and the standards that followed in the private sector, including the power status, which might be less stringent than yours. I mean, it might not, it's not necessarily a bad thing to have government subjected to stricter tests, but at least we need to have all these contexts in place so that we know what. But just lastly, I would also want you to cover what your experiences are in the implementation of this directive, from the feedback, if at all, of auditees, or purely from your own observations of trends among auditees. Do we have enough capacity with among auditees to fully comprehend the levels of standards of directives that you're implementing, the audit standards, and is it just purely an issue of lack of, or also are there other structural constraints embedded in the system itself that makes it almost impossible for auditees to actually comply with your standards, even if they know the standards and they're willing to implement the standards. So I'm just saying those are the issues that I would want in the course of your presentation to address yourself to if you are in a position to do so. I just interrupted him after his introductory part, and I wouldn't want to appropriate the opportunity to myself, and also if colleagues also want to raise issues at this introductory level before you go.
The gentleman from the Auditor General indicated his submission will be 15 minutes. I think we've written our 20 minutes. So can he not finish and then we all address our questions to him? You know, I think in that sense we will need to start.
Now, we're in a situation where they have to repeat himself to cover a lot of issues, but it's fine. Can you proceed with your question?
Tim, thank you for the statements and comments you've made, and I will make an effort to incorporate all of that in the responses I offer you now. Chair, the key features that serve to provide a compendium of instructions to auditors out there, auditors of parastatal, other auditors who work on our behalf, as to how is it they should conduct their work, and also serve to plug some gaps where there may be a choice of interpretation, and the AG has chosen to offer some guidance in that space. So the five key areas here is it defines what functions can and should be performed in terms of the Public Audit Act. It also assists entities to know what is prescribed in respect of their financial statements. This is how they go about compiling their financial statements. The third question is, what constitutes a valid reporting framework? It's an important question for auditors to have to answer in a formal way. And so we make an effort to answer that question. The fourth one is a logistical arrangement around the timing and submission of information for audit services. And then a whole lot of instructions around the audit entities not performed by the Auditor General. Now, Mr. Chairman, you posed a question, and I think you've given us the broad outline of the response to it in what you put forward. I think it's been a teaching in South Africa over several years in that we are now able to present to Parliament and to all of our stakeholders audit outcomes without making the distinction anymore between the audits that we have done and the audits that others have done on our behalf. And this directive, together with all of the other initiatives that have been taking place since the introduction of Public Audit Act, has brought us to that position. So that we, with some confidence, can go out there to all of our stakeholders and say, the profession has come a long way in addressing all of the dimensions of what constitutes a public sector audit. If we change nothing in this directive, they continue to do it the way they have done well last year. However, our own sides have shifted. We want to do more and we want to take them along with us on that road. And so the range of audit outcomes around the country are truly bankable. They're consistent in many ways. And just yesterday, the Audit General said how pleasing it is to be able to, he's on the last leg of his roadshow, not to have to respond to that question among stakeholders around the question of consistency. The question of consistency, at least between firms and us, has been significantly addressed by the initiatives that that have been underway. I think that also helps to understand the response to the second question, which is what has been our experience in implementation of the directive. And indeed, that is perhaps the most important element of it. That where several years ago we would find an auditor to not be aware that they need to be doing compliance work, or an auditor not to be aware that they have to audit service delivery reporting. No incident of that comes readily to mind anymore, that such a thing exists amongst the hundreds of public entities and parastatals out there, that indeed there is this uniformity of practice around it. Another important impact that this has had is the awareness has become so great, and I didn't mention the Independent Regulatory Board of Washington just a few minutes ago. They are at this time preparing guidance of their own to talk to the entire audit profession in South Africa, that this is what public sector audit is. And my colleagues tell me that this is the only country in the world where the Independent Regulatory Board for Auditors is guiding its members and creating awareness among its members around what it means to be a good public sector auditor. It's groundbreaking, and they, at their institute, are very proud of this work that they've been partnering with the Auditor General to strengthen their auditors working in our space. There's an important question around capacity and the level of interest and ability in our audit. And let me try to answer that just in a little while here. The last slide, and then I'll be able to wrap up very quickly, is, so what are the key changes? Besides for the plain language change, which tries to simplify the document in several places, in the core financial audit opinion, Chair, we're not proposing any change. We believe that the audit standard and our approach to it is in the right place and consistent with the way the international world is at the moment. So there's no change that needs to be addressed through the directive. In the area of service delivery reporting, or in more technical jargon, the audit of performance objectives, AOPO, we're introducing one new dimension. It has been our practice to include a conclusion on our audit of services will be reporting up to now only on high capacity municipalities. And we're introducing this, that it is time to extend this conclusion to low and medium capacity municipalities. So it means is that we will audit the service delivery reporting information they put forward, but carry forward into our report a conclusion on this matter. And after we've evaluated everything, this is how we think, this is our conclusion on it. And what it will mean, Chair, is that next year, when we bring the MFMA also outcome to share with you and other stakeholders, for the first time we'll give you a complete picture of service delivery reporting for the entire municipal government sphere, for the whole local government sphere. So we'll be able to have that. At the moment, these conclusions are there, but they're not elevated to the audit report. We've not published them, and we're saying that that's what should happen now. The next big change, and members of the committee will find this very interesting because of your own interest in compliance matters, is that our audit director spells out for ourselves and for our partners out there that these are the focus areas, subject matters that we are very interested in compliance. You know, the range of compliances, the universe is very wide, but our focus, for instance, is procurement. Procurement is an important consideration, and then we've identified that it is in the directive, this is the legislation that you should test when we talk about procurement. And we provide a list of those focus areas together with a list of legislations that addresses it. What this allows us to do, Chair, is that we are able to, with confidence, say that these are countrywide findings on the matter of procurement. Because we're able to consistently do this at 280 municipalities, we're consistently able to do it at 200 plus PFMA entities. If all of my auditors are doing it and every private sector auditor is doing it, then I can bring complete audit outcomes pictures to you. And it offers one further enhancement. I think you'll appreciate this as a user of our report. It says that in the past, when you discuss non-compliance, perhaps you said there is non-compliance with the Appropriation Act, or you said there is non-compliance with the Municipal Systems Act, and so we reported this in a legalistic way, which act has not been complied with. Instead, we're saying, in an effort to make this easier to understand, why not package the non-compliance under the focus area? That in respect of procurement is the theme, the non-compliance may be across a range of legislation. So let's not report on each piece of legislation, let's report on the theme. So anyone interested in procurement issues would find it under a dedicated procurement heading. The other areas in which the focus areas are, in the area of governance, we'll have findings around audit, internal audits and audit committees. In the area of budgets, the prescripts around budgets exist in many pieces of legislation. You'll now be able to find in our report one heading talking to the subject of budgets and all the, if any, areas of non-compliance reported within that. And I think it's going to make for a more streamlined reporting. So that I can quickly run through the subject matter areas, and they're in paragraph 9 of our report. The first is strategic planning and performance management, the second is budget, the third is financial statements, audit committees and internal audit, procurement and contract management, HR, transfer of funds, revenue management, asset management, financial misconduct, and service delivery, and the range of laws that we will test this all to start off with. The last comment then to make on the changes, Chair, are of an administrative or logistical nature. We are introducing a clause that talks to how the auditee can complain about their audit experience. So we've provided some detailed instruction about it in the directive. Not that they didn't have this power before, we're just offering it in that advice. This is how you could go about dealing with an issue of service. The second is we are reminding or entrenching what is already well known deadline so that private audit firms work according to the public sector schedule. Our experience, though, Chair, is that in respect of the last paraschedule, they report well ahead of the deadline. They these deadlines are not problematic to them. We're just making known that this is what is needed so that we can then bring other reports to you and don't accommodate changes or delays that could affect national reporting. The national reporting is very important. And as members of the committee are aware, the question of deadlines, at least in respect of PFMA, the compliance figures were high up in the 90s in respect of submission of financial statements. It is a very pleasing situation. It's not the same case in respect of the MFMA. But that's the last logistical matter to address there. Chair, I want to try to answer your second remark around the capacity of and level in our auditees. I think when we reflect on the audience that this is directed to, the large health space will certainly have more, not less, capacity than and trained individuals and modern and advanced systems to be able to deal with their accounting needs. This addresses the audit needs, which I guess is the other side of the coin, yeah. The flip of the coin. And modern system, well, auditing doesn't exist in isolation, as you know, it's there because it helps to give assurance about the reporting needs of the users. So while we say a report must be delivered in a particular period of time, modern systems are in a position to deliver and cater for those things. I also can repeat the point that there is already countrywide compliance with the elements in the directive. I guess the area where we're pushing the envelope is in the municipal service reporting. So we're not introducing a new requirement on the municipalities. We're introducing a real new requirement on ourselves that we will bring forward the conclusions of the report. So there's no new burden on the municipalities there at all. Chair, with those few words, allow me to stop. Thank you.
All right, colleagues, that is in brief. Are there any questions, comments? Floor is yours. Yes, Mr. Coroner.
Thank you, Chairperson. I don't know whether it's appropriate to ask this question in this floor, but what I want to know is that the private order fees, are they similar to your fees? Second question I want to know, have you done a study to see what is cheaper to you? The private order fee on a subcontract or through your officers? And thirdly, in the Finance Standing Committee's report to Parliament, we have asked Public Works or other institutions to negotiate it down professional fees when people are asked to do business with the state. Now, I want to know, I know with attorneys, and I know with auditors, that you are in a position to negotiate down professional fees. I want to know whether when you use private order firms, do you ask for a discount?
I know that we dealt with this issue last year already, but this time we can relook at it again. Ms. Gray, do you have a question? Yes, I'm listening.
Thank you, sir, and thank you for the presentation. I think if we deal with audit challenges as well.
Yes.
I
think there's another presentation that's coming the next year.
The matter of audit challenges was dealt with during the last sitting of the committee. When the question of budgets was introduced. However, I'm happy to take any points of clarification or any questions. I just do not have separate slides on this matter.
It's my fault. But let's feel free to, because all of that is going to be part of the stress plan that we're going to approve anyway. So maybe I should allow Mr. Singh to go ahead and with his question, and then we'll just see the college. Whether directive or retired.
Thank you, Chair. Yeah, just following on Honourable Polnoff, the question of your costs
vis-à-vis the private sector. Now, there is a section that my colleague showed me here on page 2, where you say extra charges lower order fees compared to the market rate. There's a comment in one of these documents, lower market. Now, you do go out to the market though, to do work for you. So do you peg their rate to what you would normally charge an entity or a department? In the past 2 weeks or so, I've been in touch with a couple of CFOs in passing, both of whom told me that the fees that are charged by EXA are exorbitant. And it puts a lot of pressure on them as small entities, organizations, to be able to pay these audit fees. And I don't know if this should be seen in light of the number of audit fees that are not paying, or the high outstanding amount, the millions that are outstanding. So if you can just give us a comment on that. Secondly, Chairperson, on the question of complaints, when I look at this document here that you produced, the general notice, which is a very comprehensive. Now, can we have an idea of the number? Is it a new thing, complaints? I think it's a new. But in terms of the complaints, it has to be addressed to the complaints manager. Now, from there, where does it go? Can this oversight mechanism also be made aware of complaints of a serious nature leveled against the office of the Auditor General, so that we could be in the loop? The last question here relates to timing. Now, I do know that we heard in another committee that by the end of July, normally your office has completed the audit, management letters have been exchanged, etc., etc., etc. Now, the rules of Parliament provide that annual reports must be submitted by the end of September, tabled by the end of September. But Chairperson, and I think this will be relevant to you, who sits on the Rules Committee as well, and you're a prominent member of the Rules Committee, that with these DRR reports that have been raised to Parliament in the last week or so, there is a section there which refers to comments from SCOPA on the audited financial statements of the Department. Now, I'm speaking as a SCOPA person. It's not possible for SCOPA to provide any comment because we don't see these annual reports until October or so. And then we have 300 of them that we have to go through. But yes, SCOPA is required to provide a comment. So what happens is the committee itself has to make a comment on the audited financial statements, which they are doing. Now, my question is, these reports are the property of the department, the Auditor General's report. But can these reports at the end of July not be made available through rule change to SCOPA? So, the financial statements only, the report on the financial statements. So, some comment can be given that can be included in the BRR reports when they are tabled in Parliament. I hope you get the
Actually, I'm going to respond to some of the issues myself, but let me allow everybody else to raise the issues. Yes, Dr. George.
Thank you, Chairman. Thank you for the presentation. My question is really related to what Honourable King has mentioned. Something that's been worrying me for quite a while is that the Auditor General does a lot of work, obviously. You go into the process, you look at the numbers, and then you ask about it, and you find something. Sometimes you find really horrendous things, and you report on it. But I always wonder, so what? Because the process takes a very long time, as Mr. Singh said, and I think that needs to be attended to. But, and I know that Parliament has a certain role to play as well, because we look at the report, and then we do certain things. But it's not nearly tight enough. The consequences are not nearly tight enough. So, for example, when the Auditor General finds that the accounting office, for example, hasn't done the job they're supposed to have been doing, and, you know, there's really been no consequence whatsoever. There needs to be tightening up somewhere in the process. Now, I know that you do a job and it ends, and then somebody else has to do something, but I certainly feel very strongly that there needs to be a tightening up of the process so that the finding of the Auditor General leads to a consequence. So if somebody has stolen the people's money, for example, that they get punished appropriately. That's what's supposed to be happening. And I fear at the moment it's a lot of money that gets spent and a lot of pressure that gets generated, but the ceiling just goes on. The 30 billion rand that leaked out of the financial system, for example. So I don't think the process is working, and we need to fix that. Thank you, Chair.
And I must say I appreciate your interest in the work of the committee. I failed you by not making sure that by today you are made a full member of the committee. But I hope we'll put it out soon.
I was just wondering, alone, if it is not possible for the Office of the Auditor General when reporting to actually quantify the number of tenders that goes to a single individual or a single firm. You know, because from where I sit, I mean, any cement of the country, and women are suffering in this country. There's poverty. And, you know, I think it is also the cause of all this uprising, because there is pressure on poverty. And when many tenders get given to one individual, at the end of the day, the projects are not completed. Who suffers? The grassroots, the women, the poorest of the poor. And the next year, the same person gets the test. He hasn't finished five others. That is a big one to me from where I sit as the ANC women pick. And we would need to get to the bottom of that to make sure that actually there is fairness in the sharing of the wealth of the country. Because you can't load a tenant on one person when there are 500 other people who need jobs. We are never going to solve this joblessness if we go on like this. And we really need the assistance of the Auditor General to say, she lacks sure basically when we've got 15 tenants. And how many projects have been completed? And we need to do something. About if we get such a report, my understanding is that I am a decision maker. We'll take the decision. We will take the decision. It's our job to do that. But we need just this anticipation. Thank you.
Honorable Ken.
Thank you, Chair. I don't know, mine is around the issue of procurement, but I think it would lead to partly what my colleague said, raised the concern that the Auditor General, it's a continuous situation, year in and year out, where you found that we recognize these challenges. You give the report in terms of these are the procurement challenges that you have. But once again, in terms of teeth that were bited and what measures are you putting into place? I hear you saying that we need to test the legislation around the issues of procurement, even including supply chain management. But at what point do we then start treating it as a matter of urgency to ensure that, you know, there's a tapering down of the problems that we're experiencing? Because that also just continues. There's no significant change or there's no significant action that is visible, that is taken. Is it because you don't have the necessary power as the Auditor General, or is it because before we can review or change that legislation, there's nothing much that can be done? And if that is the instance, then how do we work towards that, including in terms of our own oversight, to ensure that that does happen? Thank you, Chair.
I want to add a point, but before I do that, I also just want to raise a few issues from where I'm sitting, because I'm part of the rules, I hear your rules, I'm the strategy and a few other things. One, to say this, you look at the constitution, the democratic institution, especially those that have to investigate and report, it is clear that their function is essentially to support the oversight role of the legislative arm of the state. You know, essentially the democracy is structured on, it's a three-legged pool. We make the laws and exercise oversight, the executive implement, and then the judiciary adjudicate on disputes and enforce the law. Now, the fourth empire and the fourth state, which is your chapter 9 and the chapter 10 and the chapter 11, are there to do the technical, scientific, professional work that produces the evidence. But we have not perfected our governance system to a point where it becomes seamless. So that once they have reported, we are able first and foremost to understand with absolute precision what it is that they are telling us. With absolute precision, what is it from where we're sitting as oversight we need to prosecute or pursue? Logical conclusion. In other words, when we then interface with the department, with the entity, what is it that that interface, that interaction entails? All right? And what becomes the outcome, and how do we follow up to make sure that as Parliament, if we say something needs to be done, actually ends up being done. And part of what needs to happen is that was part of the follow-up question or comment that I made yesterday to the President, the collaboration, the interaction between the minister, the executive, I wouldn't say ministers because I'm talking all 3 years now, and the legislative arm is absolutely right, because they need to understand clearly what it is that we are seeing, so that they see what we see. And then we're able to interact closely in terms of what is it that then is, without blurring the separation of power. So I think this is an issue which Parliament as an institution, at least at the national level, really needs to begin to grapple with and defend. The BPR process, somebody alluded to. And the question was asked about rules and the honorable. Let me tell you, the Rules Committee had mandated us to work on rules for the implementation of the Money Matters Amendment Act, the one that amended, the one on the basis of which the BPR work. Now, we've said we're only going to deal with the formal requirements of that act in the rules. We won't deal with the substantive issues because the act itself has so over-legislated the processes that it leaves very little room for rules. But secondly, the way in which it tightened up the time frames is such that committees must test it out and give feedback as to whether this is working or not. And if it's not working, what will work better? So that we don't overload a system that itself needs to be reviewed, overburden it with a set of rules on top of that, which are just going to further complicate without changing anything. Because remember, the rules cannot alter what's already there. So what we anticipating is a situation where at a certain point, whether it's a budget committee, whether it's some other process, the Speaker's office, would lead to a point that says, these are the shortcomings of the system that's been created under the Act. These are the amendments that need to be effected. These are the aspects which will be completely removed out of the Act, so that we can then come with the rules to fill in those gaps properly. Because part of the problem is that once the Act has limited your space to
design
according to rules, then you don't have much leeway. And I think a lot of committees have been complaining that the process is just not workable. It doesn't allow the space to really, and certain things are not jailing there. But that is the kind of discussion and feedback, I think, which portfolio committees should report on.
so that it's recorded in specific terms, a recommendation, so that at some point those recommendations can be collated. But I think for us as this committee, if we have identified specific issues within the scope of our own work, that should go into our own recommendations in our report. I think we should report on those issues as well. Mm-hmm. One of the issues that we may want to report on, for example, is issues relating to the need for Parliament to tighten, you know, the system around how the Auditor General's report, SCOPA, the portfolio committee, Parliament itself, coordinate their work in such a way that the issues identified can be able to be dealt with more effectively. So I'm just saying those are some of the issues that we need to deal with. And I also just on a separate issue, the issue of the tariffs, want to remind us that we had a lengthy discussion of this last year. Just to remind us, and without preempting the other tones, that some of the issues that we dealt with were that it's a contentious issue between auditors and the institution and the private firms. Private firms want the tariffs to go up, because they are forced to bring the tariffs down, because what they charge in the private sector is a lot higher than what the Auditor General is prepared to pay. Auditees find the tariffs to be too high.
Person, can I just say, I came here to listen to them, and with due respect to the chair, can we finish with the Auditor General, and then we can have an interview with the chairperson? But you know, when can I then engage and start asking you questions with regard to the point you've just made, that private audit firms are more expensive than the Auditor General? It's completely my opposite experience.
I'm merely reminding members what was discussed and presented previously. But I indicated they will have the freedom to actually talk to the issue. I thought I'm entitled to also express my views. Well, it was the turn for members to speak, and they were going to respond. And I'm also raising issues too. I don't know what difficulty you have with that. Yes, I'm a chair, but I'm also entitled to raise issues for them to react to. I don't know what your problem is. Anyway, well, the experience is different there. All right. On that note, can you please react?
Chief, there is a question around the question of fees. I really appreciate the opportunity to clarify this, because it's not a matter that is rare. It does come up from time to time. I think there are reasons why we in the Auditor General and you in Parliament all celebrate the fact that we have a leading supreme audit institution in the world. There are some elements that lead to an office being recognized in that industry. Elements of it are the governance arrangements of the office, the work of this committee, the work of Parliament and the legislation that oversees us, the leadership of our own office, the professionalization of our staff. We now have over 450 chartered accountants working in the Auditor General's office, an immense resource, and a very big change to where we were 10 years ago. And one big element of this reason why we were leading to the Auditor Institution is because of our financial arrangements, the financial independence of the Office of the Auditor General to be able to do the things that we do. Now, with that preamble, I'm able then to respond firstly to the suite of questions posed by Honorable Quernhoff in respect of the fee arrangement generally. So, I am in the privileged position, and I say this explicitly, of being the one responsible in the office for negotiating fees with the profession. And let me explain this in three steps. the profession, and let's take a name, a Deloitte or a Gobodo or a CUS Aduba, who are out there, have their own prices. And their price list for regular work, call it maybe 500 Rand an hour. We as the Auditor General have our own price list for a particular level of staff. At that level of staff, in the same example, maybe 300 Rand an hour. And the difference between their prices and our prices is that they're generating a profit to pay to their partners. We do not need to generate a profit. We're only aiming for a 2% buffer, a surplus, to keep us solvent. And so that would be the gap, for instance, at that price level. Maybe 500 Rand in the private firm and 300 Rand of our own. Now, however, this is the rate I would charge the Department of Health if I'm doing an audit for them. However, if a Gobodo or a Deloitte come by to my office and want to do work for us, they face this problem. If they recognize that when we do work out there, we can get 500 Rand an hour, your own rate internally at 300 Rand, and you're only aiming to break even. That's not why we exist. We don't exist to break even. What is the rate that you're going to pitch for us? And those rates in South Africa have a name. Those rates are known as the spiker rate. So between this 500 Rand and the 300 Rand, there is a tariff in between. That tariff is known as the South African Institute of Chartered Accountant rates. Those are rates that are negotiated with the Auditor General's office, and the rates that we say, this is what we're happy to pay. If I use that example, perhaps that rate settles at 400 Rand. Now, the impact of that rate is that when a Gobodo or a Deloitte comes to do work for the AG, we will only ever pay them at that 400 Rand rate. It does not matter the size of the assignment, where in the country the assignment is, we'll only ever do that. And we have no shortage of private firms willing to do business with us at this discounted rate. Now, in the example I've given, this discounted rate is 20% cheaper than what that firm would be charging its commercial clients. But it has a much bigger impact when we talk about the comment that Honorable Gwenock made in respect of the work of the Finance Standing Committee. Because government is not only a buyer of audit services from auditing firms, it also buys consultancy work. And many, many cases tender prescribe that the consultancy work also be done at this mid-tariff level. So a Gobodo or a Deloitte who wants to do work with government may be forced by the tender that goes out that says we're only prepared to pay the FICA stroke AG rate. And so what would have cost 500 an hour normally if they're doing the work for a private company or for a bank, because they're doing the work for government, they have to use this negotiated AG rate. The tension here is that the firms visit us every year through their representative body, the Institute of Chartered Accountants, trying to negotiate that 400 up with a range of justifications.
Our approach, at least
for the last 2 years, has been not to offer anything more than what is there. Okay. The way the firms keep up with the inflation adjustment is that this appears on a scale. So if your salary is this, the rate is 400 Rand. If your salary is that, the rate is a little bit more. So as the salaries of staff in that firm go up, their hourly charge out rates go up. But they don't make more money out of government because their rates go up. So I offer that as the background to how this happens. So indeed, it is cheaper, substantially cheaper than the work that the AG does, because we simply don't make a profit. The work we contract out is done at a rate far lower than the private firms do when they do work, when they do audit work even. And so when we say that without risk of any contradiction. Now, Chair, in the strategic plan we brought to the committee a few weeks ago, we actually brought all the rates. So it's in the paperwork that you have, and we show them alongside each other. We say that these are the rates we will be charging when we do the work directly. But in the next appendix, we say these are the rates we have negotiated with the profession for the 500 million men of work the profession does on our behalf. But potentially, the profession uses it for the range of other activities also, this discounted tariff. Despite that, Chair,
we're faced with the very important comment that Honorable Tim makes, that our stakeholders believe that audits are expensive. And they go so far as to describe audit fees as being excessive. I'm faced with the other side of this, that my staff believe they're underpaid. Because one of the costs of a great audit office is to have an audit office with lots of professional people. And I'm competing with the same firm that I described a minute ago. Yet here, this is a very serious tension. Because we cannot ignore people saying that fees are high. At the same time, Honorable Singh makes the point that, AG, we know well how much of trouble you have in just collecting these debtors. Our debtors' book, give or take something, at the moment is 400 million rand. 400 million rand. And a significant portion of that is local government debtors. So, you know, there is a fee, but they're in arrears, they're not paying. And so that is a cost. There's an element to how we carry this. However, Chair, this year, and members may recall from Honorable Makwetu's DAG's presentation a few weeks ago, the AG has decided to proactively address this. And so we've done two key things, Chair. The first is that for the last 3 years, we were budgeting a surplus. So after everything is taken care of, what is the bottom line? We were budgeting a surplus of 4%. Which you can accept is really a very small surplus under the circumstances. However, with the benefit of the last 3 years, we're more convinced that our internal financial discipline is well bedded down and our numbers are very predictable. So we've been ending the year with surpluses. So this year in our blue book, Chair, we're saying we have got enough courage to reduce our forecast surplus. No longer do we think we need 4%. We've dropped our proposal to only 2%. So at the bottom line, we think we only need to make half the money that we used to make before. Because we're so much more confident about our own system that it will get us to that number reliably. So on that level alone, we're discounting our net profit by 50%. So that's amongst the things that the committee is approving in the budget plan. A forecast of 4% to 2%. And that's a message which we would like to take to all of our constituencies. That the message is heard, our own systems are mature enough for now to be able to do that. However, Chair, we've also done one more thing, and this is where we can speak directly to your constituency and others around the question of audit fees. So how much is my fee going to go up next year, is the question they would like to know. The answer to this always has been, well, how much are my salaries going to go up? If my salaries go up 10%, I'm going to expect that my fees are going to go up by the same amount. And that's the equation that we have followed over the years. So we do our salary projection based on where we think the inflation rate is going to be and the inflation rate for the audit profession against what we're competing and the shortages in the profession. And we're predicting that that number for next year is approximately 8.5%. We're predicting that the salary increase is going to be approximately 8.5%. The question is, how much do we increase our own tariff? Do we do so by 8.5%? Next year, we're recommending a 5.1% increase. So the AGSA tariffs to go up by only 5.1% versus a forecast salary adjustment of 8.6%. This means that there is a gap. We're going to be paying Linda and Shamadine and CSC more that we're going to be recovering from our clients. Chair, that number, which Mr. Makwetu would have shared with the committee last time around, it has a rand value. What will this discount mean? This discount is 41 million rand. This is what we would absorb and give us a smaller margin at the bottom line. Of course, it's 41 million rand shared over a range of policies. It's not that their fees are going to go down, but the adjustment is going to be 5% as opposed to 8.6% or 7.1%, whatever the other. And I hope that to the best of our ability shows how we've responded to this in two different ways. We don't believe that this is sustainable in the long term because there's only so many 40 million rand discounts you can give before the 2% becomes zero, and then we start making a loss again. But indeed, this year we're in a position to be able to come and come forward proactively with this proposal. Chair, the Deputy Auditor General has also asked me to mention that a later occasion, you will revert to the committee again in terms of the Public Policy Act around the committee's advice on our surplus from last year and the surplus of the year before. The last 2 years of offices made a surplus after many, many years of losses, and the Public Policy Act's permission to allow the AG to retain some of that surplus after discussions and advice from the committee. But that's something that we're not ready to talk with you about today, but it is something that we'll come back about. Chair, on the question of complaints, that's a question posed by Honourable Singh. Yes, the first response to say is that the complaints policy, there is a complaints policy in the office, and the policy is not new. It's been in existence for a long time. We're using the directive as a means of publicizing it. We're just using the directive as a means of publicizing it. And do I have the statistics around what they are? I think it's a great point that I just proved that the reason we don't know the answer to this is because the complaints officer is the ethics officer of the organization who reports to the Deputy Auditor General. So I do not know those numbers or the nature of those cases because they have a very tight reporting line to the Deputy Auditor General. So I would not even guess whether there are one case or three cases that have come through. But that's the extent to which I can respond on that. And I believe the chair has the chair has responded to the question that was posed to the chair around the annual reporting and the tabling. Can I just make the point, Chair, that we give audit reports to auditees. If auditees do not table in time, then the Public Audit Act instructs us to table. So no one can keep a report away from you longer than the Act allows them from Parliament longer than the Act allows them to. We will step into that void and make it available if need be. But of course, we won't bring a report directly to you in the normal course of events because the system is very well established. Chair, then onto the set of questions posed by Honourable George around the question of consequences. I think there's two elements that I can respond with here. The first is the review work that is taking place in respect of the Public Audit Act. This is another matter that is somewhere on the agenda of this committee, and that provides an opportunity for such questions to be expanded upon and potentially meaningful answers obtained. It's not hard to agree fully with the contention that Honourable George makes as to the question of accountability and consequences. But Chair, it's not a question that we're saying, let's wait until the Audit Act is revised before we do something about it. Our reaction to it is, yes indeed, there may be people to chase for last year's theft, but what are we doing to prevent this year's theft? What are we doing to prevent this year's loss? And importantly, what are we doing to ensure better audit outcomes and better delivery? So while there is the word we use to describe what our Auditor General does and what we all do is roadshows, but as he said yesterday in the Western Cape Legislature and as he's reiterated before, is to say to all of our stakeholders, last year's results present this picture. This is what it says about unauthorized expenditure. This is what it says about service delivery reporting. Give me a commitment, face to face. What do you undertake to do about this? And the process starts with getting commitments from the respective minister for that portfolio, confirming those commitments with the premier of the province. Premier, your MECs have all given us these commitments. So now you know what you can do to keep them on track. And then taking those commitments and going to the legislature and saying, our partners in oversight, these are the questions you can ask during oversight because the premier has committed to do this. And then not leaving them for a whole year before we come back, but our teams go back every 3 months and ask the question around, these are the commitments you made. If we want to change the audit outcome, how far have you gone? What can change? And we do this thing that we call smiley faces and dashboards. And you see, you realize that your dashboard has all red faces. 6 months have passed, you've made commitments, they're all still red. Unless you do something about it, the year-end picture is going to be unchanged. And our teams are out, and we say this without risk of contradiction, every day of the year, they're visiting every one of our audit teams on a quarterly basis, having a key control discussion about how we're going to change last year's audit outcomes so that this year's better. This is because, so the emphasis then is, once all these commitments are obtained as chair, then we have this signature report of the office called the general report. And we do it twice a year. And we take those commitments and we put them in writing and bring them to Parliament. So my general report has a chapter that's called commitments. So not only is it backward looking, this is the outcome, but it's also forward looking. It says these are the commitments we have gone and extracted from the people who can make a difference. And who are those people? There are the HODs, the ministers, the premiers, the legislators, but also all of those coordinating departments. Salda, what have you? What can you do to help? National Treasury, what can you do to help? Provincial COFTA, what are you committing to do? And the range of those commitments are all captured in that. So, Chair, that's just a comprehensive answer around this thing. So give everyone the tools to be able to deal with improving audit outcomes. There's a pair of questions, and I hope I get the names correctly from Honourable Shoke Lituli and Honourable Bikani. My expert on supply chain management would really like to answer this question, especially since the first part talked to a gender issue as well. With your permission, Chair, can I ask the minister to assist with answering that?
Thank you very much.
Thank you
very much for your questions on procurement. The audit procurement and contract management is one of the very specific focus areas within the AG, and the Auditor General has been for the past 2 years putting additional emphasis on it than more than we've ever done before. If we understand our role, if we enable oversight, accountability and governance by means of how we audit and report, and by focusing on this, we've been able to bring a lot more things into the spotlight of what is happening in procurement, and especially if we are looking at now going to the second MSMA cycle doing this, the findings that we are seeing is very concerning. We've been focusing on this with the idea that there's a role that we play. Our role is to bring this to the public, is to bring this to oversight, and that's also why we made this change in terms of the way that we are doing our compliance audits. It's a lot of these issues used to be reported to management, because we understand that the role of the accounting officer as well as the executive is to deal with these issues, to make sure that the financial misconduct are dealt with, that the regular expenditure are dealt with in a specific way. These matters we are now bringing into the audit report, so it also comes into the domain of oversight to deal with this. We've got a very specific focus also now on looking what happens, why is there so little in terms of accountability being done, because the rules are very clear about financial misconduct. What is this financial misconduct, how it should be dealt with, and the same thing with your regular expenditure. So in those areas, we're looking very much towards first the accounting officer to deal with it. Now with this quarterly interaction, it moves closer to the executive, because the executive has got a very specific role in terms of that as well. And then the first level we're taking to is now going for oversight. Like these, here is the fact, this is what's on the table and something needs to be done. The successes we've seen so far is, which is in a way it's disappointing, is that there's more of an awareness now as audit chiefs of what the rules are. That they are not always aware that they are very specific rules in terms of preferential procurement, for instance. We would identify that some of the public entities, as well as even some systemic enterprises reporting are not aware of this differential procurement that might happen, which for us is not only a disappointment, but we didn't expect that actually. And the question with regard to the same who's getting offended, and I think that is we would really, yeah, if we were able to do this, we would really love to be able to do that kind of analysis. I think we are sitting in a time place with Treasury, for instance, with this as well, that we don't have a centralized system to be able to see who's getting all the things. The only place where there is something like that is with the Construction Industry Development Board, where they do have all construction projects are registered, so that kind of analysis can be done, but even there is very little compliance in that area. There's been an infrastructure, there's been a performance audit on infrastructure, and that report has been tabled, I think, last week, which points to the specific one as well. The capability of supply of specific contracts when it comes to construction, that they can, that they are, they might have the ability to run one or two contracts at once, but not many. And that's a problem the OSTs also have, Dave, that when the adjudication committees, they do have to make a call on whether a contractor does have the ability to perform this work, but they don't have the facts. So they don't know how many other contracts this contractor is also working on. And we are really aware that National Treasury is also, that identifies the same problems as well as construction development board, as well as obviously the competition commission is also very interested in this information to be able to see who is the top supplier. This is something that will take that also back as a comment as well for looking towards how we can maybe do more work in terms of that. We've got a little bit of information we can work with, so we'll work that into our audit as well to address that. But the procurement, especially in the procurement side, the work that we do is only successful if we can see action being taken on it, and that's how we also see it. And that's why we also continue to work with, for instance, National Treasury, and we're seeing in which ways the systems and the processes can improve. And I have been able to bring out a number of new instructions, and you would have heard that the minister also pronounced in last year's medium-term budget speech the new control measures that trying to put in place, especially based on the audits that we've done in terms of conflict of interest. And this year, my specific comments also about strengthening some of the accountability to measures as well. We had a discussion with the National Treasury staff, and they are also working on starting some of the regulations in terms of this as well. I think what maybe just one, if you allow me one comment about the audit fees. As we are talking about the audit fees and we're comparing the work that's been done in private sector, work such as doing very additional work on something like procurement, it's not about the tariff, it's about the hours. We go into a lot more detail on these kinds of areas, the same thing as the service delivery reporting, the level of work that's done in private sector, in a private company, auditing a private company, they only look at the financial statements. Being public sector auditors, we do a lot more work in terms of compliance. You would have seen the list of laws and regulations that we need to take into account, and the work that we do on performance information and service delivery is not done in private sector. This is only done in public sector. And in terms of hours, it takes more hours to do these things as well.
All right. Are you confident with your responses? Look, with the limited time, really, we cannot go into some of the detail here. I just want to indicate that, firstly, with regard to the review of the Act, We have for some time now made a request to work on what you would propose initially for our consideration as areas that you think are shortcomings that a review process would need to address based on the experience of operationalizing the Act in 2004. So we still are waiting for that feedback. But in that, also pointed out, and I want to repeat this, that where we identify shortcomings in other regulatory frameworks that impact efficacy to achieve your objective, say the procurement legislation or any other legislation, point those to us. So that even though they may not necessarily be part of our domain, we are in our recommendations and in our power to advise under the Act. Can make recommendations that may then be carried by other committees like the Budget Committee or the Finance Committee or with other committees appropriate. So let's begin in greater measure. say in our own reporting here, nothing stops us to make some of the calls of in our report. All right, I think we'll leave matters there insofar as that process is concerned, except to say that I see here page 85 to 87 actually outlines the patterns and the schedule that you are alluding to. Honorable Kim correctly stated, in terms of the law, they consult with us and then they go and sign the act. So this is the consultation. Mm-hmm. Is there any member of the committee who has any difficulty with page 85 to 87, the draft charges that they put forward to us? And if not, then I think we should be able to give them that feedback to say if we have been the light of the feedback that they've given us, as well as the directive. Are we all happy with the clarification issue?
Mm.
Right. Yes,
yes, Chair, but I just wish we could, because it's almost every time we meet, we repeatedly get the report in terms of the possible legislative review that we need to look into. If you could please preface that, if we could eventually get some form of consolidated report on areas that you can perhaps also look into for recommendation, that you don't have to be dealing with the same thing every time you can.
I think I'll miss that.
Yeah, sure, thank you very much. I think to the extent that, was it 13.3a, there's been consultation. I mean, we all agree that there's been consultation, but it's just like the act of official to take note of some of the comments that have been made by the members. So if they need to relook and things like that, you could do so in the light of what I just said. But as far as the consultation aspect, yes, yeah, we agree.
Sorry, Chair, just to add, because I know many members were not there. We raised an issue here about this information management system and what effect it has on the way the reports are coming in determining improvement as well. That report also be included in terms of what exactly or how exactly is it going to start affecting the Auditor General's work towards us going to a point where we're able to then say we've stabilized enough to can say it's time to apply sanctions where there's been no compliance.
All right. I think that the issues have been raised, and obviously in the context of this exercise this year, we might not be able to exhaust the thing. But I think going forward, we need to build on this. For example, last year after the consultation, we invited FICA, for example, and we made it clear to FICA that this is not a bargaining chamber around time, but we did want to stay. All right. And they did their presentation and were very disciplined in the way they came across, you know. And in the end, we said, look, we hear them, but at the end of the day, it's a difficult area that we leave in your domain to make value judgment. So we're not here to try and usurp your own determining task. And along the way, we meet with the team. And just to also mention to members, I get complaints. All kinds of stakeholders, OGTs, members of the public, the media, about your work, about this or that issue, and on an ad hoc basis, I refer those issues to yourself to give me feedback, and then they liaise back with an ongoing process. If I need to present any report to the full committee on some of those issues, I'll only be too happy to do so, or even, you know, circulate copies of the correspondence. But it's work that I feel I don't need to burden the committee with, because it's all operational stuff that usually gets clarified and resolved. And if you feel that I should report on those issues in the committee, I should feel free. I also attend some of the activities and so on, and maybe I should also just report on some of those things as well. Right. Now, we need to decide how we then proceed. We have the draft report, and the minutes. Can I get an indication of our state of readiness to adopt this documentation?
let me indicate that this minor language little thing that I do get a bit frustrated with. Yes, we're finished with them. You are free to stay on, because remember, our procedure here is that our meeting includes, unless for specific reasons be excluded, includes representatives of the Auditor General or the Auditor General themselves. So it's a matter of course, we always expect somebody from their office to be present at on our official meeting, unless there's specific reasons to completely exclude them. But if you have other engagements, everybody has had a
Amsterdam and just scan through them quickly and communicate with as many interactions that you want to suggest if I put them forward option. Dr. George, have you had a chance to look at them?
Yes, and I would move for adoption. That's it.
You want for adoption any second or minute of the plan September? Alright, you do second.
Okay, you can go out and look here, you can second.
Yeah, alright. Okay, and so adopted. The next set of minutes with my document is the minutes of the 15th of September, the week that I Everybody has a copy of the minute? You had a look? Anybody who wishes to suggest any correction?
Introduction, number one.
Number one, introduction.
Yeah.
anybody?
Yes, Mr. King?
Yes, yeah, I was just looking at the subheading. The Standing Committee on the Auditor General has considered the annual report of the Auditor General dated Auditor General 2010 on the 11th November. The report is not dated the 11th November. Am I right now? Then I just thought on line and under introduction 1, 2, 3, 4, where we refer to the Public Audit Act, we can immediately there put PAA in brackets.
The second of correction.
So then later on, whenever we say PAA, we know what we're referring to.
Mm-hmm.
Sure. Then on the second, third paragraph of introduction, the 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7th line, interfere. I think there was a gremlin there. Then on the third line from the bottom, hence the mandate of the Standing Committee on Auditor General, not comma it, just stem from it. Take this out, and a comma. And then the last line of the same kind, the mandate of SCOAG is to assist and protect the ACSA to ensure its independence, impartiality, dignity, and effectiveness. Full stop.
Right. Anybody have an introduction before we go to the next one? All right, we move on. 1.1, the heading, the legislative function of the AG. I think the word legislative is not correct. It should say statutory function of the AG, because the legislative function is actually of the legislature. It has to do with making laws. I think the word statutory should replace legislative. But otherwise, under 1.1, anything else from anybody?
Yes, just on that, would it be the function of the AG or AGSA? I mean, do we look at AG as a person or?
Yeah, I think all references to AG, consistency sake, should be changed if you can do it automatically on the computer. Don't they have those programs where every reference to AG should be ASPA?
Yeah.
Right? Right?
And then, Chair, on the second last line of the first paragraph of 1.1, accounting entities. And any of the institutions or accounting entities, including.
But how this small little thing is really shouldn't be here. You guys want to check out your spell checking and grammatical check. Because really,
subject to grammatical, typing, etc., correction. without altering the essence of mindfulness. Yes, Dr. George.
Just on the recommendation number 4,
right.
The committee makes the following recommendation that the South African Dutch Government Association, blah, blah, blah. And I think we need to tighten up on that recommendation because something needs to prompt them to do it. You know what I mean? So maybe, I don't know, we write a letter to them or something. But I just fear that it will be given to report and then nothing will ever happen. So they. Association needs to be prompted to get the people to pay. Yeah, you know, to pay the money. I mean, the action step should be a little bit more robust. Thank you.
And is that the wording that you want to propose? That is the point at which we make that decision.
I just wonder that maybe, I don't know if it would be appropriate, but maybe the committee or the chairperson should write them a letter. Say, you know, noting that there's all this money outstanding in these charities, you know, get your affiliates to pay it, or put pressure on it or something. What's the objective? We want them to pay the money.
Can I just explain the process I understand it from the table stuff? Is that all the resolutions adopted by us from the staff administratively to generate correspondence to the respective department, line function, etc. What we may need to check with them is what is the monitoring mechanisms put in place. Usually SCOPA and other committees put 60 days, 30 days, or whatever it is, time frames. We haven't put in any time frames here. I think that's the difference. We might feel it's not appropriate anyway to put time frames for the matter. But that's what we need to. And of course, then we need to decide whether the recommendations are adequate to the covering of, I mean, I see only 3 items, essentially. That's what I'm more concerned about. Do we have adequate recommendations? Yeah. All right.
Chairperson, I also think that in terms of our oversight, we also need to be able to go beyond just listening and taking it that the people from ASTA would deal with it. Because it's a repeated complaint from our side. That they have to prioritize in terms of time frame also as to what can best be done to ensure that the process of ASTA being paid is speeded up. Because every time we come back, there's just no significant improvement or change in terms of the debt that's altogether.
You see, maybe they can guide us.
Yeah.
There are time frames by which, actually by when accounts should be settled. I don't know if it's a 30-day, 45-day, whatever. Maybe we could include that kind of formula here. Or simply say, as prescribed or something of that nature. I don't know if you might suggest some language that might just be more specific in terms of the obligation of auditees to meet their audit fee obligation. Should we simply say within the prescribed period or something of that nature? Is there any way you could include something of that nature?
Yeah, just to add, perhaps it would also be of significance if you could get a report, a detailed report of where the areas of municipalities where debt is still outstanding. And had an indication of the period of that outstanding debt in terms of years or months or whatever the case might be, and the amount that's outstanding, because then we'd also be able to react to that, you can say, as part of our recommendation.
So the committee recommends, let's add it as an and that the committee, and that answer finishes the National Assembly within what, the next, how long, 30 days, 60 days of a schedule of, yes.
It's very vain, like to say, already done, but
yes.
So we've given the committee secretary this report during September.
Yes.
So this report is already available with the secretary.
Maybe we should make it a quarterly affair, can we regularize the frequency with which this, because obviously it's not a one-off affair.
Sure.
It's something that should be kept alive, because the problem is alive. It is not a dead dog. It's a very alive. Is there somebody who wants to say something else?
No.
Yes, something.
See, I don't know if it would be okay to attach a schedule of the outstanding municipalities here. You see, this report here, and it also ties in with who writes to who.
Mm-hmm.
This report, once adopted by this committee, goes to the House.
Yes.
Then it becomes the property of the House.
Mm-hmm.
So the Speaker owns this report.
Mm-hmm.
So actually it should be the Speaker writing on behalf of Parliament to the Parliamentary local government, saying to him, listen here, my House has adopted this resolution, and I want you to act on it.
Mm-hmm.
We can monitor it. We can monitor the Speaker's office whether they've done that. The similar thing happens in Scopa, because it's not us to write to the executive. So I think we need
let's put in something that says, in brackets, under recommendation one, a schedule that whatever that document is called, of the 8th of September, whatever, is attached for full information, for further detail. Then that way, that schedule is part of this report, and it gives specificity to that recommendation, so that when they write to what is it called, SALGA, they also attach that schedule, so that there's evidence of what are they. All right?
Can we also then have now pigeonhole the report that was submitted in September, because some of us might have missed it later.
And it's not been taken.
So that we
okay. Anybody who hasn't used this? No, it's fine. Whoever does not have it, they can always be fetched. So feel free to request to get there. Alright, so we've dealt with the issue around the tariffs and the recommendation around that. The second recommendation, I actually want us to now focus specifically on recommendations and to finalize the report. The National Treasury, Cooperative Governance and Traditional Affairs, Provincial Leadership and Non-Paying Audits in the current initiative to improve the collection of audits. That's still linked to the first one, so you can keep it. After retain the subsurface. Okay, so this is the subsurface issue where we've been asked specifically to approve. All right, so that's the recommendation. All right, are we happy with that recommendation? Okay. Now, is there any other thing that we think arising out of our consideration of the annual report of the Auditor General we should
But as a particular point, you said that let's add the fact that we get those reports either on a quarterly basis, as you suggested, so that we can see that the tapering off of those debts.
Yeah.
Can I, before I endorse that check with yourself whether you're in a position to operationalize something of that nature. All right. So a recommendation is the edit. Maybe we can make it a second recommendation that the report be furnished to SCOEC on a quarterly basis on outstanding. What do you call it? Outstanding.
Outstanding audit fees to AXA.
Yeah, outstanding audit fees for AXA.
Let us know when you make profit so that we can come and share it.
Alright. Is there any other matter that, look, in terms of the law, the subsurface was the one issue we needed to approve. If we need to approve it in the annual report or in consideration of the annual report or in the third plan, just look raising a procedural issue. Is this where it belongs? Or is it in the report on the trust plan?
In
the annual report. So it's appropriate in okay. All right, then I assume at this stage there's no further recommendations with regard to the annual report. All right, so that's done. We then put the report, anybody who wants to move its adoption, with the corrections and the further refinement in terms of funds. Mr. Kani agrees?
I agree to adopt.
Seconded, Mr. Singh. Anybody objecting? So it is agreed. Now, finally, the stress plan. And you have the document, you have the draft report. How do you want to proceed with it? Introduction.
I suggest also that the committee, our researchers look at the grammatical, etc., etc.
Mm-hmm.
For example, on the second one, it will be on the 11th of November, and the report says follows.
Mm-hmm.
The standing committee orders the having questions and budget that on the 11th of November, 2011, the report says follows.
Mm-hmm.
And then we adopt, but we now look at the focus on the recommendation, and then adopt afterwards.
I'd like to make a comment on the issue of recommendations, because I think this is becoming a general trend also in other committees.
I want to satisfy myself that the rest of the body of the, because I want the recommendations to be dealt with very specifically, recommendation by recommendation. Anything else on any other aspect of the draft report other than recommendations that anybody wants to raise? And then proceed on recommendations.
Thank you, Chef. You know, on the issue of recommendations, very often you find that we do engage and put specific recommendations in detail. It's very important that recommendations must never be generalized. Never ever be generalized. Detail must be there and be specific so that you are able to account or support whatever needs to be supported in terms of recommendations. I'm just worried that when you get to recommendation, every time it seems as though it's an issue of just commenting that there was such an issue, but not detailing as to what the recommendations were in relation to such an issue, that the committee section moves away from summarizing recommendations. Otherwise, it's difficult to just support anything. Thank you, Chair.
I agree. I noticed that the only recommendations that I hear are recommendations that in any case are necessary, but the substantive issues that we have identified in our engagement, maybe partly because some of the discussions we missed out of the meeting today, shouldn't we formulate two or three recommendations arising out of our deliberation? I wasn't there the last meeting, but I don't know if there were any further issues that warrant going to recommendations that emerged. But certainly arising from today, the one issue was that around the procurement cost, we noted, I think, the dedicated focus, what did you call it, focus area, a shift from reporting on compliance with legislation to thematic areas of focus. Just clarify the concept there again for me, and maybe I'll suggest a formulation for a recommendation.
Chair, the way you touch it now is better than I
can.
Yeah, our traditional approach was to report by piece of legislation.
Mm.
Our proposal was to report by thematic area.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think the shift in the auditing, is it auditing, is it performance auditing?
Is it the auditing?
That the shift in the auditing from a focus on statutory compliance to compliance to what? Thematic compliance or performance compliance. What is it? I'm trying to find a proper way of capturing the shift in approach to a statute-based focus to a statute-based auditing to a focus and thematic based auditing is endorsed, but that with regard to procurement, we had issues around procurement where we said that, you know, greater improved monitoring on procurement needs to be effected. You know, the issue about where to.
I was including the word that there be a focus on thematic areas would then necessitate us in future that, not necessarily at this point in time, but the fact that you stated that there will be focus on thematic areas and per thematic area, obviously somewhere along the line, procurement, for example, would be included. Then we tabulate other specific thematic areas as to what are the areas of focus that you need, whether it's the government or legislative or whatever else, procurement or whatever, depending on what thematic area we'll be dealing with.
It's endorsed, but that an improvement is needed in the monitoring, improvement of monitoring, recommends that the monitoring systems be improved to ensure greater compliance with policies such as procurement legislation and policies of that nature.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe we'll work out an exact formula, but I think the concept really is that we need to make sure that one of the things that happens is that there is sufficient information about what is actually happening, and so that the thing can be monitored effectively. I think that's the essence of what we can't reach.
Yeah, we can only submit something to
right. Yeah, we'll think of a formulation around that.
Yeah.
Maybe they can assist us in formulating it.
I think so.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah, the same caveat. Approved.
Yeah.
With amendments.
Yeah.
But please speculate for final rule.
Yeah. Okay. No, that's fine. All right. On that note, then, we adopt the report subject to the changes. What? Who moved? Did somebody move?
I move for adoption, Chair.
Anybody seconding? With the agreed adjustment, the report is going to adopt. Okay. Right. Now, that concludes our work on the consideration of both reports and the minutes, and I suppose that then concludes our business for the day.
Yeah.
And therefore, I'm in a position to release you.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you.